Glad that long title didn't scare you off tonight. And thank you, Dad, for that opening. I will also be going to the book of Job, and I can't remember if I'm going to be reading those exact verses, but it's going to be right around there. So, I was asked, Hans asked me to have this topic a while back, and he loaned me a stack of books, and I looked through the stack, and I picked out The Case for Faith by Lee Strobel. I'm curious if any of you have read it. No one, okay. It's a pretty good book. I don't agree with everything in it, but in it, Strobel investigates 8 objections to Christianity, and he investigates these objections. He interviews other believers, and he writes a rebuttal. I'm going to be looking at 2 of those 8 objections. My topic tonight is sort of in 3 parts, I think I can make a coherent topic out of those 3 parts. First of all, I want to talk about the title, The Innate Consciousness of God. What is that? Then I want to take a look at 2 chapters in this book. And finally, I want to finish up by talking a little bit about faith and doubt. What is faith, and what do we do with doubts? The existence of God is a hot topic. Not just the existence of God, but the nature of God. But everyone, Christians and atheists, agree that it matters what you believe or what you decide. Whether God exists or not, it's pretty important to know the truth. Because that changes everything, doesn't it? So what about the innate consciousness? Now, if you look at all cultures and people groups all around the world, you'll find that nearly everyone agrees on many basic things. They appreciate beauty. They value human life. They regard human life as separate and unique from animal life. And humans crave meaning and purpose. They avoid suffering. And they agree that suffering is bad. Now, atheists try to explain human behavior with evolution. They'll talk about how, you know, we evolved to cooperate, work together, live in tribes, and pass on our genes, keep the human race going. A lot of their explanations sound logical on the surface, but I think they fall short in many areas. First of all, survival of the fittest. That was Darwin's thing. Have you really thought about what the world would look like if humans actually lived by that rule? The survival of the fittest? Yeah, it'd be terrible. It'd be chaos. Now humans believe in individual sovereignty. And what I mean in this case by sovereignty is that they recognize that each person has rights over their own body and over their own possessions also. An individual's rights over their own body is the most important right that our justice system recognizes. Our justice system serves out the harshest punishments for crimes against a person's body, physical or sexual assault. Now, if we're just highly evolved apes, who cares? Why does it matter? If survival of the fittest is the ultimate good, how can you punish someone for trying to survive at the expense of others? Another thing about humans is the way we care for the weak and disabled. Now, I'm sure you will occasionally see that in the animal kingdom. I'm sure you can find examples, but no animals care for the weak and helpless like humans do. And you can't really use evolution to explain that. Caring for someone who can't help the tribe, who's a person whose very existence is a detriment to the tribe, honestly. We have the innate conviction that lives have value, even if they can't directly benefit us. Another innate idea is the idea of justice. Now, atheists will say there are no moral absolutes. And they have to say that because if there are moral absolutes, then there is a higher power. And they're not willing to go down that road. Have you ever met anyone who honestly believes there are no moral absolutes? I haven't. You know, even criminals know the difference between right and wrong. Think about the worst criminal you've ever heard of, whoever that would be. Well, if someone sneaks into his prison cell when he's out in the gym or at yard and steals his TV, he'll be outraged. No matter what crimes he's committed in the past, he knows that's my TV. That guy has no right to steal my TV. So yeah, even people who live lawlessly know there's the difference between right and wrong. Lastly, is that earthly things can never really satisfy our deepest needs. There's always that nagging feeling that there's got to be something more to life. A quote by C.S. Lewis is, "The fact that our heart yearns for something earth cannot supply is proof that heaven must be our home." So these are some of the things that I believe show the imprint of the Creator on our hearts. So now I want to move on and look at two of the chapters in this book, two objections that people raise against the idea of a loving God. First of all, I'm sure you saw this coming, how can a loving God allow suffering? One of the most common objections raised by unbelievers, and even believers, certainly. Lee Strobel begins this book with really a very sad story about a man, Charles Templeton. I don't think I had ever heard this story, but he was an evangelist, a friend, I think even a partner with Billy Graham. Templeton was a preacher, and some people even predicted Templeton would eventually eclipse Graham, Billy Graham, as an evangelist. And then Templeton turned away from the faith. First of all, I'll read about Templeton's conversion. He was becoming disgusted with a life of pleasure. He was on the sports staff at the Toronto Globe, and one night, coming home from a sleazy club, it says, feeling shoddy and unclean, he went to his room and knelt by his bed in the darkness. Suddenly, he would later recall, it was as though a black blanket had been draped over me. A sense of guilt pervaded my entire mind and body. The only words that would come were, Lord, come down, come down. And then, slowly, a weight began to lift, a weight as heavy as I. It passed through my thighs, my torso, my arms and shoulders, and lifted off. An ineffable warmth began to suffuse my body. It seemed that a light had turned on in my chest and that it had cleansed me. I hardly dared breathe, fearing that I might alter or end the moment, and I heard myself whispering softly over and over again, thank you, Lord, thank you, thank you, thank you. Later in bed, I lay quietly at the center of a radiant, overwhelming, all-pervasive happiness. Sounds like a pretty convincing conversion, right? So he left his job at left journalism, joined the ministry, and began touring with Billy Graham. And then it said, but soon doubts began gnawing at Templeton. I had gone through a conversion experience as an incredibly green youth, he recalled later. I lacked the intellectual skills and the theological training needed to buttress my beliefs when, as was inevitable, questions and doubts began to plague me. My reason had begun to challenge and sometimes to rebut the central beliefs of the Christian faith. So he began to drift away from God, and then Billy Graham started going through his own crisis of faith. But he finally committed to accept the word by faith. Going on, Strobel writes, for Graham, it was a pivotal moment. For Templeton, though, it was a bitterly disappointing turn of events. He committed intellectual suicide by closing his mind, Templeton declared. The emotion he felt most toward his friend was pity. Now, on different paths, their lives began to diverge. Well, Strobel actually went to visit Templeton as he was writing this book. By that point, Templeton was beginning to suffer from Alzheimer's. He could still think pretty clearly, but he knew this disease was going to get him eventually. And here's what he had to say. Alzheimer's would not exist if there were a loving God, and because it does exist, that's one more bit of persuasive evidence that God does not. He went on then also to tell Strobel about a picture he had seen in Life magazine. Quote, it was a picture of a black woman in northern Africa, explained. They were experiencing a devastating drought, and she was holding her dead baby in her arms and looking up to heaven with the most forlorn expression. I looked at it and I thought, is it possible to believe there is a loving or caring creator when all this woman needed was rain? Well, so Strobel was interviewing Kreeft. Let me see, what was his first name? Peter Kreeft. And he told Kreeft what Templeton had said about this picture. Said, it's significant that most objections to the existence of God from the problem of suffering come from outside observers who are quite comfortable, whereas those who actually suffer are, as often as not, made into stronger believers by their suffering. So I thought that was really interesting. That really it depends more on your own reaction or how you respond to suffering. Well, here's the thing. People who are suffering believe that their suffering matters. No one says, oh, well, I'm just a chunk of meat that randomly evolved from goo over millions of years, so my suffering doesn't matter, doesn't make any difference. So I believe the fact that humans have the moral knowledge to recognize suffering and that suffering is bad is further evidence of the innate knowledge of God. And I believe that the Christian faith explains suffering better than any other belief system. I heard a quote once went something like, Christians struggle to explain evil. Atheists struggle to explain good. So now I'd like to open it up for some feedback from you. Do any of you care to share anything about how suffering has drawn you closer to God? That's a pretty personal question, but I'd be interested to know if anyone has a story to share. No one wants to speak up. That's fine. Now I want to read a little from the book of Job. At the beginning of this year, I started a 1 year chronological Bible reading plan, and let's see, it goes through Genesis 11. That's right, and then it goes to Job, because Job is one of the oldest books. So, incidentally, I'm about exactly at this point here. In my personal devotions, so at the end of the book, God shows himself to Job and to his friends, and instead of giving answers, God asks questions, which is really interesting. Going to start at Job 38. I'll read verses 1 to 7. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now, gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Who set its measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy." And the next two or three chapters continue like that, just a barrage of questions from God to Job. Then Job 42, chapter 42, 1 to 6. Then Job answered the Lord and said, "I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear now, and I will speak. I will ask you, and you instruct me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I retract, and I repent in dust and ashes." So Job never got the answers to his questions, but he saw God. And I think that is the answer to suffering, is seeing God and experiencing his presence. Another thing about suffering is that God sent his son to suffer for us. God is not separate and aloof from our suffering. God partakes in it. And I guess so far, I've mostly been talking about physical suffering, pain and loss, but I think one of the worst pains that humans suffer is the fear that their life is meaningless. Well, think about it. If there is no God, life is meaningless. But if life is meaningless, why do we experience such anguish when we feel like life is meaningless? I think that's one more example of the awareness of God that has been planted in our hearts. moving on to the second objection that people raise is, how can a loving God send people to hell? And I have personally wrestled with this question. I've lived a pretty easy life. I haven't experienced much suffering. And this question of hell really has bothered me a lot more than the question than the problem of evil and suffering. So Strobel interviewed J.P. Moreland about hell, and there's at least one point on which I strongly disagree with him. That is, Moreland believes there is no literal fire in hell. He explains that the flames are a figure of speech. Now, if Revelation were the only book that talked about the fires of hell, maybe I could agree with him, but I did just a quick Bible search, and there are lots of other verses aside from Revelation that talk about the fires of hell. So I personally think it's literal. Moreland goes on to say that the worst thing about hell is separation from God. And that I do, I think I agree with that. He also said, well, and I've heard this idea from other elsewhere too, that it would, for a sinner who's rejected God, I think what Moreland was saying is being in heaven in the presence of God would be worse than being separated from the presence of God. I don't know. That's an interesting thought. So Strobel asked Moreland, why is everyone punished the same way? Why does the non-believer who lived a pretty good life otherwise spend eternity in the same place that the very worst mass murderers go? Moreland responded that there are different levels of punishment in hell. I think he's right. In Matthew 11, Jesus denounced the cities that had rejected the gospel. He said, it will be more tolerable for Sodom on the day of judgment than for you. There's another verse in the Bible where Jesus, I think it is after one of his parables, where Jesus says, the servant who knew his master's will and did not do it will be beaten with many stripes. The servant who did not know his master's will be beaten with few stripes. Okay, so what's your feedback? What comments do you have on this?
I wonder why people who blame God for suffering, why is the blame always directed towards?
Okay. Good question. Daryl.
Maybe to highlight what's going on there, I think it has to do with the Christian claim that God is the source of everything.
Okay.
So to have anything, the claim is if God is the source of all, then evil must have come from God. Of course, the Christian answer is that evil is the absence of good.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also, if God is all-powerful, he could keep bad things from happening, right?
I believe that.
So ultimately, it's even if the devil caused it to happen, God could have kept it from happening, right? If he's all-powerful. Okay? More comments on that?
In fact, I believe that he must cringe and restrain his wrath while his grand scheme is played out, because surely he is scandalized by evil.
Daryl.
So I'm kind of piggybacking on top of what Gary just said here. I'm absolutely agreeing with you. I think the parable of the wheat and the tares helps us get a bit of a picture of how God views good and evil.
Yeah.
And how he values good much, much differently than we do. Or rather, he does not see evil. How should I say it? Good is more important than the evil that exists. So the good is more important than eradicating all of the evil.
Mm-hmm.
Our actions can contribute to somebody else's being hurt and having suffering.
Okay, another question I have. What about those who've never heard the gospel? Will they spend eternity separated from God? What are your thoughts on that?
makes it easy, perhaps makes it at least graspable. When Jimmy Carter was through the Annapolis Naval Academy and was being commissioned, he interviewed with Admiral Hyman Rickover, who asked him, when you were at the Academy, did you always do your best? And he said, no, not always. Which was, of course, the only right answer. And the Admiral said, why not? And I don't know where the conversation went from there, but that person that you described facing God won't need to answer what did you do with Jesus Christ, but
okay.
Put a law in your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Always follow that law. Why not?
Mm-hmm. That's a good answer. I talked earlier about our innate knowledge of justice and our desire, our craving for justice. I think the reality of hell teaches us about God's justice, or at least reminds us of God's justice. Would you really want to serve a God who doesn't punish evil? Well, I don't. And as far as the uncomfortable questions around hell, if what I just asked about what about those who've never heard the gospel, if we really believe God is just, then that's all we need to know. He's not going to punish anyone more or less than they deserve. And I think that's just where we have to leave it. Okay. Now, what do we do about doubts? I think every Christian struggles with doubt at some point. And sometimes over and over again. But faith is belief in something you cannot prove. If you could prove it, you wouldn't have faith. I have wished that God would make himself more clearly known to me. I wished he'd answer some of my questions more clearly. But I think God gives every person what they need. Faith is a choice. Strobel illustrates that with a personal story that occurred before he was a believer. Reading from Strobel's book here, I told Willard about the time when my newborn daughter was rushed into intensive care because of a mysterious illness that was threatening her life. The doctors weren't able to diagnose it. Even though I was an atheist, I was so desperate that I actually prayed and implored God, if he existed, to heal her. A short time later, she astounded everyone by getting completely better. The doctors were left scratching their heads. My response, I told Willard, was to explain it away. I said, what a coincidence. She must have had some bacteria or virus that spontaneously disappeared. I couldn't even consider the possibility that God had acted. Instead, I stayed in my atheism. So, faith is a choice. And I want to say something here for anyone who's struggling with doubt. First of all, remember that Satan is the father of lies, and these are some of the lies that he tells us about doubt. You're the only one who is struggling with this. Have you ever felt that way? Another lie from Satan. You can't be a Christian if you struggle with these doubts. Or look at brother so-and-so or sister so-and-so over there. They don't have the doubts that you do. Doubting does not make you a bad Christian. Everyone faces doubts, and it's what you do with them, what you do with those doubts that really matter. We're almost out of time, but does someone want to share a personal story about how they've dealt with doubt or what has strengthened your faith? That's right.
He did the illustration of someone being married. Or maybe, I don't know if it ever happens, if they have a doubt about that. Well, that doesn't change the fact they don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. Yeah, that's exactly right. Thank you. Well, look at the heroes of faith listed in Hebrews 11. And look at the mistakes that some of them made. Yet they pleased God with their faith. So, you can do it too. Look at Abraham. It sure looks like he doubted God's promise. By the way, he took matters into his own hands. But still, he's mentioned as a man of great faith. So the having great faith doesn't mean you never doubt. I think the real measure of faith is obedience to God. So, one more thing I want to say, since we're talking about the arguments, you know, for the existence of God, one caution I want to just throw out here is be careful when debating with unbelievers or skeptics. I think debate is a good thing. And I also think it's really good for us to be knowledgeable about apologetics, the arguments for or against. But I think it's really important that we're honest with ourselves about the limitations of reason. And don't make a nuisance of yourself. No one likes to be badgered. Just accept that we cannot force anyone to accept truth. The most compelling testimony is a life lived for Christ, and the most compelling evidence, I think, is the work of the Holy Spirit in a person's heart, and that's something you can't force by debating. So anyway, that's all I have to share. Thank you for your input. I think it's good to question our beliefs occasionally and ask ourselves why we believe what we believe. So I hope this evening has helped strengthen your faith.